Welcome to Prison Pipeline. I'm Karen James. On January 22, 2020, Oregon Humanities held the second event in its Portland Think and Drink series, Making Democracy, focused on democracy, justice, and the courts, with three major figures in criminal justice in Oregon: Oregon Supreme Court Justice Adrian Nelson, Benton County District Attorney John Haroldson, and Shannon White, Deputy Director of Partnership for Safety and Justice. We'll hear a portion of Making Democracy, emceed by Adam Davis, with Oregon Humanities. Oregon Humanities connects Oregonians to ideas that change lives and transform communities.
On behalf of Oregon Humanities, I want to say a big welcome to all of you, and I hope you will join me in saying a big welcome to John Haroldson, Shannon White, and Adrian Nelson. The theme of the evening is democracy and justice, or democracy in the courts. My name's Adam Davis. I'm with Oregon Humanities. This series of Think and Drink events is on the theme Making Democracy, which feels like a timely theme. And we're trying to think about questions that have to do with democracy over the long term and what strengthens democracy, not just today and not just at the next election, but how we make it stronger. And so tonight, we're going to be thinking about how the courts and democracy go together. So I guess I want to ask the three of you here fairly early, when you think about the justice system, what's it for?
What comes to mind for me first is that we all inherited an imperfect system. It's critical for us to recognize that, embrace that, acknowledge that, because what we do in a democratic society is help that system evolve, help it get better. When we speak of the justice system, we have to first recognize, as someone far brighter than I once said, we have a number of issues with our justice system, but it's the best one in the world. And so I would argue that the reason that the justice system is good and it's the best in the world is because it is dynamic. And it has that ability to evolve into a better system if we do the work to make that happen.
Right.
Shannon, go, yeah.
I would venture to say possibly that the system is perfect as it was intended.
That's right.
And that it is actually executing exactly what it wants to do, which is to disempower and marginalize all kinds of communities. You can see through history how it got bigger, how it was a reaction, how you end slavery and you get convict leasing, and that system pulled people right back into slavery, and on and on and on. And so I think it's possible we have the best system in, no, there are a few others that are better, but there are a lot that are worse, and I think it is actually designed to do what it's doing, and that is the fundamental problem.
And for me, I don't call it the justice system.
Great.
I call it the legal system.
Okay.
Because I know it's a structure.
Yeah.
And I understood the structure. And I understood that you needed people on the inside working to make the system maybe not work as intended, but be for everyone. And how long it's going to take, because it's not going to happen overnight, and it's going to be incremental. But to also have people on the outside so that you can hold those people who are working accountable. I feel very strongly that our legal system is made for everyone in our country, but that's not the reality for many, many people. And that it is confusing to many people when you call it the justice system, and we have Lady Justice and Justice is Blind and all of those different terms that are used to associate. But the reality of it is that it was a system for some people to win and others to lose. And how it was determined was based on your socioeconomic status, your race, your gender, your zip code, in a lot of ways. And until we're honest with each other that that's the basis of our system and that we want it to be better than where it started, that's where we're going to be able to make it the justice system.
I want to push a little bit here. Whether we call it the justice system or the legal system, and we're talking both about where it came from, what it's been like, where it is now, I want to ask the question what it's for one more time, and maybe I should ask it more aspirationally. What should the legal system or the justice system be for?
Well, it should be a place where people can get resolution for problems that they can't resolve on their own. I mean, there is a real need. The legal system does provide benefits. You know, it didn't start to help domestic violence victims, to really address sex trafficking, things that we have decided that we're going to do. Our legal system has shifted from being totally punitive to being more treatment-focused, to where we're having treatment courts on different issues to acknowledge that there is some intersection on what is happening outside of our courtrooms and having a responsibility to look at it differently, to bring the sciences in. I do believe that many people who are involved in the system want to do the right thing. They are trying to do the right thing, but there's a lot of overwhelming processes going on. You know, we realize that we deal with people who are in state of brokenness so often at the trial court level, and we can't do it all. But you can definitely try and do the most you can with what you have for as many people at that time and then keep trying to grow it.
What is it for? I think it is for holding harm accountable when it can't be held any other way. And I don't think treatment should happen in the system, because that treatment needs to happen outside of the system. The system is way, way, way too big. We are trying, as I mentioned, starting around homelessness, we are trying to, with the least cost and least long-term investment, create an answer to long-term systemic issues that should be outside of the system. So I think the system should be narrow. It should be focused on real harm that can't be held accountable in other ways. So we have to move folks who are struggling with mental health, homelessness, substance abuse disorder out of the system and into other systems.
I agree.
At the risk of sounding trite, the justice system is for justice in the purest sense. Now, we aspire to justice, to think about the phrase that we recite, justice for all, right? And we talk about inalienable rights, and we base the foundation of the principles of this country on these concepts. And yet, do we really have it? It's aspirational in that sense. And so in the purest sense, we can speak about that, while at the same time recognizing the importance of making the investment and understanding the system and the dynamics. Because we hear often examples of intentional acts of discrimination. But we also have to be cognizant of the fact that when you inherit an imperfect system, there can be aspects of that system that bring implicit bias that have a negative impact, no matter how good your intentions are. So I'll share really quickly an anecdote that I think illustrates that point. As a young prosecutor many years ago, I was in court one day, and I was before a judge who was a fine, well-intended judge, kind man. And there was an interpreter there. The accused was a young Latino man, facing a misdemeanor charge. I don't remember what it is now, but in either case, he was being arraigned, and that's where you're given your rights, the maximum penalties and so forth, and asked how you plead, guilty or not guilty. And on that particular occasion, and we didn't have the same standards that we do today with regards to interpreters, the judge asked him how he pled guilty or not guilty, and the interpreter said, "Como se declara, culpable o sin culpa?" And the young man says, "Culpable?" And the interpreter says, "He says guilty, Your Honor." Okay. Now, as the prosecutor, I stood and I said, as an officer of the court, it's my duty to report that Spanish is my first language, and the response was one of ambivalence. On behalf of the state, I asked that a lawyer be appointed so that he can have a meaningful opportunity to engage in this process. Now, both the interpreter and the judge had great intentions. However, there was something missing in that dynamic. And the lesson that I took away from it was that when our communities are not represented in positions of leadership, no matter what system it is, that there will be injustices no matter how good the intention is.
In a way, it sounded like all three of you are pointing to, if we talk about what should the legal system or the justice system be, it should be more inclusive. It should be...
Yes.
I want to push back towards Should it be more democratic? Are there ways that the legal system depends on things that are not democratic?
Well, democracy should be more inclusive.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
I think you can argue or actually even outline that the criminal justice system is an anti-democratic tool, right? Like it's literally been used, as you had Desmond Mead here a couple months ago, to talk about felony disenfranchisement and people who've been convicted of crimes not being able to vote. That makes no logical sense. Mm. If someone goes to prison for 5 years for robbery, why aren't they voting, right? Like, it is literally a way of marginalizing voices.
Do you all understand what a district attorney does?
Great, great question. Yeah.
Maybe you should explain
it. All right,
to
let's
them
start with this.
Okay.
In the purest sense, okay, in the purest sense, the role of the prosecutor is to seek justice through the truth. The role of the defense attorney is to represent the best interests of their client. And if either side steps away from their responsibility, the system will fail. So the decisions that we make are decisions that demand our best attention, our best consideration, and they demand that we consider all of the relevant information before us at each critical decision point. Now, that might sound like a great standard, at least in theory, but this is a critical piece. It's a critical piece because as our criminal justice system evolves, we've learned more about ourselves as human beings, our brain development, addiction, different factors that come into play. Okay, and as we learn more, we learn about DNA, we learn about different investigative techniques and so forth, there's more information to consider today than we've ever had before, and a year from now, even more so. So do we set up our systems in a way that supports us having that information to make the best possible, the most highly informed decisions? Or do we allow ourselves to become complacent? I like to say that sometimes we find comfort in complacency. And if we do that, then we risk adopting a system where we're making those critical decisions, but we're not considering all the relevant information we should be considering. Remember, the goal is justice. It's an imperfect system. But I will say I have been blessed in working for district attorneys who gave me complete discretion to base my decisions on that standard. And I never had anyone looking over my shoulders saying, you're going to prosecute this case you don't believe in. But I have dismissed a case in the middle of trial with a witness on the stand because it didn't meet that standard. And so as we work on these issues, that's really our calling, really, from the judges. The judges are having to consider more information than they've ever considered before. Defense attorneys, the same. And similarly, juries. We're all growing with the system.
Mm-hmm. And you said partway through that the goal is justice. What do you mean when you say justice?
I think it's hard to define because it's different for every person. So I was thinking about a family that several years ago, someone called me from the family because harm had happened between families, between the family, right? Which a lot of harm happens actually between people that know each other more than strangers. And harm had happened, and they wanted to figure out how to hold the young person who'd caused the harm accountable. And we called some lawyers, and the truth was there was no way to hold that kid accountable without triggering the legal system, which the family didn't want, all those ramifications. So I ended up calling the Oregon Youth Authority, our youth corrections system, and finding out the name of a workbook they use for these kinds of crimes. The family ordered it. One family member held that young person accountable. And you know what the victims got? Nothing, because they couldn't go to a therapist even and have them not be a mandatory reporter and trigger criminal consequences for the other person. What that family really wanted was professional help and healing, and what they had to do was use a workbook that our correction system, they were a totally different state, used to help create justice in their family. So I think there's no clean definition of justice because families and individuals want different things, and that's, I don't think our system truly has the flexibility to do that work.
That's right.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to an Oregon Humanities event with Oregon Supreme Court Justice Adrian Nelson, Benton County District Attorney John Haroldson, and Shannon White, Deputy Director of Partnership for Safety and Justice.
This question of defining justice is so important to me. Yeah. And it's been important to philosophers, for such a long time. There are treatises written on this subject. Sure. I agree 100% that justice, that the answer to that is going to be different for each individual. Now, we can say it's being fair, as I would say in Spanish, no es justo, it's not fair, okay? And we know, we feel it. So we see something that's an injustice, we feel it, okay? But we throw the word justice around without pausing in this fast-paced society to ask ourselves, how do we define it? Mm-hmm. Now, I am in the business of my calling, what my goal, and for everyone in my office, is to seek justice through the truth. And if we cannot define what justice is, then what on earth are we seeking?
Yeah.
So to that end, I say this. Each year, I will meet with the lawyers of my office and ask each person to define that. Mm-hmm. And it's evolving, because what we thought was justice 5 years ago might not be justice at all today. And what we think is justice today may not be justice next year, okay? And so to that end, one of the fascinating aspects of that, when we consider what our own values and principles are, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness as some fundamental, inalienable right, that aspiration can form the bedrock for how we are assessing justice and what we seek in that process. And then finally, to that point, in understanding that, what I have found in the course of my life is justice requires two components to exist. One, you must have community, and the second, you must have love. You've got to care about the community.
That's right.
And if you don't care about the community, you're not going to have justice. And to make this point, if we think about national politics today and ask ourselves where the component of love is, we will find that with the absence of it, we will see injustice, and we continue to see that.
So true.
I mean, it's interesting to use words like community and love. Mm-hmm. And to think, we didn't market this event with the three of you around community and love. And it's interesting that that's what we're moving towards.
Yeah.
That the more we talk about justice with the three of you who are working in the legal system and the justice system, that it's moving in that direction feels slightly surprising and also slightly encouraging. I guess I want to go back, Shannon, to you on this and ask this question around, especially coming as trying to push the system. Does it feel like we can push this system towards being more accommodating of or driven by community and love? Or does that feel too far a push?
Well, as I said before, I think first we've got to focus on shrinking this system. Like the last 20, 30, 40 years, the growth of the criminal justice system, not just the prisons, but who's on probation, who's on parole, is so massive that we have to focus to get that sense of community and love back. We have to shrink the system. We can't have parents pulled away from their children when they don't need to be, and kids locked up and taken out of school. Like, these aren't the kinds of things that create loving communities. So I think that's the first thing we have to do. And I think, I don't know, I'm not super interested in the system becoming a loving space, because that'll make more people judges want to send them there. I want it to be small and narrow, and for people who really can't be held accountable in any other way. Norway has a prison system, and this is what I thought of when maybe there's another place with a slightly better system. We have 14,000 people in prison in Oregon, and if we had the same prison rate as Norway, we'd have 4,000 people in prison. Now, Norway's prisons, or at least they're moving to this model, actually, I think, are loving human places, but they are for folks who really can't be held accountable any other way. So they have committed the most heinous crimes, and yet they're living in little apartments where they have their own kitchens and knives, and they're trusted to be individuals. So maybe, but I think, when we have 4,000 people in prison in Oregon, let's have that loving community.
Adrian, from within the system. And not just from within the system, but from like a fairly high place within the system. What do you hope for from the system that you're in and well positioned in?
You know, I really want the system to be able to work on both the civil and the criminal side. The civil side has a different perspective in terms of resolving the conflicts, but they have just as serious implications as people who are in the criminal system. You know, you make decisions around housing, you make decisions around employment, you make decisions around health, all kinds of things that can affect your daily living and actually your wealth building and generational decisions that can be made. I really want our system to work where people can come and get an answer. They're not always going to get the answer they want, but I want people to be able to know that they're going to be heard, fully heard, that they're going to be considered, and that they're going to be able to have a resolution. It's a very complicated question, and it depends on where you sit, but everybody that I've talked to, when they come to the legal system, often what they want is a decision. And that's very strange to a lot of people, but it's like, I can't resolve it any other way, and I might be able to live with whatever it is, but I need a decision so that I can move forward. And when I started thinking about it and breaking it down that way, it didn't feel so daunting, you know, because I started representing people who had lots of issues and or found themselves in the legal system, and my goal was to get them out of the system and to keep them out of the system. I didn't want it to be a revolving door, and then I had to have different roles.
So as we start to move a little bit towards the end of this part and towards questions, okay. I have two more short questions and maybe trying to get more concrete towards the end here a little bit. The first one is just if you could point towards one or two concrete changes that you would like to see from your entry point that would maybe move us more towards justice for all, the way you talked about earlier, and maybe even if also towards a smaller system. But one or two concrete changes that you think are reachable and that you think it would be helpful for us to hear here while we're talking about this.
First, we are at a historical time of demographic conversion across this country where the majority will change. But we have not kept up with that demographic change in positions of power in all systems, including the criminal justice system. And it's not the fault of the votes or just one thing. There's so many factors that go into that. In other words, you know, if there isn't a lot of diversity among judges, we really have to ask, is there a lot of diversity among the lawyers across the board? Is there enough diversity in law schools? Is there enough diversity in college? You know, what are we doing with respect to all of those components in order to ensure that we have that inclusivity that will bring the insights necessary to be able to have a more inclusive system? Number two, and tied into that, is education. Now, oftentimes we hear ideas that sound good, but they don't necessarily empower underrepresented and underserved communities. In 31 years of prosecution, I can tell you anecdotally that the overwhelming majority of people that we see are people from the lower economic sector with limited education. And when we begin to look at the demographic among some of those groups, okay, the issues are compounded. So what would the world look like if every person had an opportunity to get a college education and they didn't have to pay for that? Okay, what would that look like? What impact would that have on our justice system? What impact does it ultimately have when we reduce the hope of human beings? It doesn't matter who you are. If you take away hope from a human being, where will that lead you? And if you create a dynamic that has great hope, not only is that inspiring, but that hope can exist because you're prepared to take the opportunities that are before you and to be able to grow, to build that self-esteem. So there's some components that are critical for that evolution because they empower those who have been disempowered. And so in terms of two things that I would like to see that I believe that we can truly accomplish is to take the steps to ensure the most inclusive and equity-based environment and systems, and two, to promote those empowering systems like education so that we can promote hope and to begin to change that dynamic. Finally, with regards to the issue of underrepresented and underserved communities and this absence of love, think about the history we have of blaming people as being the problem. Think about, I mean, it's countless, but an example, you know, close to home for me is think about the repeated denigration of Latinos and how, you know, we get conditioned to a point where there's children that are taken away from their parents and put in cages. And where does that leave us? You know, so if we develop some policies where we're checking some boxes, maybe it feels a little bit better, but is it really empowering? Are we making that change? And that's where my hope lies. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So you know that I work for an organization that tries to make change, so I have 200 ideas that I'm going to try and pretend are only two. Because we have a framework at my organization, Partnership for Safety and Justice, that we work around in terms of how we think about addressing the system. And one is to shrink it, as I've been talking about. And we want to be thinking about what victims are getting and people convicted of crime. That's part of how we do our work. And also equitable outcomes, because the more you shrink or have diversion programs or treatment programs, the more often there is to be bias. So always looking to make sure that everyone's being treated equitably as we have more options. So we shrink, and then we like to promote innovation. Like, think about the ways we can do justice differently. How can we develop programs, hopefully outside of the system as much as possible, that create accountability and healing in ways that people and families and communities really want? And then we have this much smaller system.
So I agree with everything that John and Shannon have said, and I was thinking when you said concretely.
Yeah.
So, all right. I really think that every person who comes into our legal system should have legal representation. And I know that people think that you get a lawyer for many things. You only get a lawyer because of policy decisions in certain counties for criminal cases. In a civil case, most of the time people are self-represented, which we're changing that term from self-represented to unrepresented. And within our system, we're having access to justice summons and talking about that because we're seeing people come to our courts that are being held accountable to legal standards as if they're lawyers and having to navigate a system and not understanding. So I think that it would be an incredible thing for everyone to not qualify for an attorney, but to have an attorney that can help them navigate that system, to help them understand the language, to demystify the process, understand how to weigh their options, know what their options are so they can decide, make some decisions. And I agree we need to be more innovative. We need to figure out how to bring more technology into our spaces. And part of that is that the legal system, the judicial branch, as the third branch of government, has to be fully funded. Because quite frankly, it's not. And if you don't have the funds to be able to provide the lawyers, to provide the technology, you're going to keep going in this circle that keeps changing and probably getting smaller.